Great. Good afternoon, everybody. It's 12:03 p.m. I'm going to call, this is Board Chair David Corus. I'm going to call the meeting to order. I'm going to start with roll call in no particular order, and we have some new board members, and I will introduce them sort of as we get to them. But I'll start with Vice Chair Grant Westerson.
Good morning.
Good morning. Brian Thompson.
Here.
We have, let's see, Paul Hinch.
Here.
And we have new representation since last year. We have a new state treasurer, Eric Russell, and he has designated Doug Delena. Doug.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
We also have new representation from the Department of Transportation. We have a new commissioner, Garrett Ugolito, and his designee is Chuck Roman, although I don't believe either are able to make it here today. Chuck, you're not here, I don't think. Okay. John Johnson.
He's here.
Yeah, John was here. We'll come back to him. Parker Wise.
I'm sorry. I'm here, David. I was unmuted.
Yeah, no worries. Okay, I hear John and I hear Parker. Thank you. Dave Perillo.
I'm here.
Thank you. Tom Patton.
Here.
Thank you. Felix Reyes.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon. I'd like to introduce another new member. Our member, Larry McHugh, has resigned from the board. He recently retired from his position leading the Middlesex Chamber, as I think folks are aware. And we have a new appointee from House Speaker Ritter, U.S. Navy retired Captain John Carter. Welcome, John.
Hey, thank you very much. Happy to be aboard and here.
Right. Alexandra Daum, I don't believe, is able to make it today. Tom Gill?
Here.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dave.
And Judy Scheifel. Judy Scheifel. Okay, with 12 members present, we have a clear quorum. Thank you all. The next item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from the December 20th regular meeting. I'll entertain a motion and second, and then any discussion. Is there a motion to approve the regular meeting board minutes from December 20th?
So moved, David.
Moved by John. Is there a second? Second by Grant. Any comments, discussion, or requested changes? Okay. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions?
This is Doug Delena. I'll abstain as I was not a member of the board at the time of that meeting.
Yep, noted. John, you'll abstain as well, I presume?
Correct.
Great. Any others? Okay. Next item on our agenda, item 3, is public comment. Andrew, please open the lines, and any members of the public who wish to speak at this time, please state your name.
Sure. The public line is open. I'll remind folks that wish to speak to please press *6 to unmute yourself, and then please state your name. Oh, sorry about that. I hit the wrong button on the public line. The line is open. If there are any members on the public who wish to speak at this time, please press *6 to unmute your line, and then state your name.
Kevin Blacker, can you hear me, Andrew?
Yep, I can hear you. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, we can hear you, Mr. Blacker. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So I'm hoping that somebody will address whether it's Marlon Peter at ACOM or Ulysses Heyman or somebody is willing to address the dense graded aggregate issue that's taking place at State Pier. I'm not sure whether, you know, the dispute is between Kiewit and Kobelec or whether it is directly between the Port Authority and Kobelec. You know, but I'm told the issue was in arbitration. It is either moved into court or is heading for court. That there's it's roughly, you know, depending on who you talk to, of you know, $400,000 to over $500,000 dispute of the dense graded aggregate that had to be pulled out. If anybody has you know, been over by Ginger's Oil in Westerly, they can clearly see the size of the pile. I'd estimate it. You know, it's got to be in the vicinity of 15,000 tons. So a very large amount of material was removed and it is at stake. Anybody that knows, you know, that I would expect if I was in Kobelec's position, I would be attempting to place a lien on the job. And given the necessity, you know, that the tight schedule that you guys have, that could create a serious problem. So I hope that is addressed and that the board is aware of that. I listened in on the finance committee meeting, heard that you guys are running, I think it's in the vicinity of a few hundred thousand dollars in the red. And I heard discussion of expected payments. And I know that, you know, it was described that you were expecting this to be a tight year. I wouldn't say that running, you know, 200 and whatever thousand or however many hundred thousand in the red is tight. That's, you know, that's a problem. And expected payments is really something you guys, and I hope the press, you know, pays attention to that word expected. Those payments are not guaranteed. You guys are hoping. You've taken an incredible risk with public money on something that's not in the bag. You're over budget again. You know, as I understand it, those payments are still in question. So I think that the finance director, Veronica Cowper, talked about trying to position those figures in a positive light or in the most positive light. But I don't think that any way you look at it, when I hear those numbers and you talk about, when we talk about a project that's $255.5 million in out of money and is going to go over again, and then you talk about these payments that you're going to be receiving or the state is going to be receiving of, you know, quarterly payments of $500,000, so $2 million a year. And you try and just from a common sense, average citizen, you know, small business person, you say, we're going to spend $255 or $275 million. And then they're going to, you know, rent it for $2 million a year, and ten years, the best 10 years. I know that you know you'll try and say, well, it's these upgrades are gonna, you know, position it for the long term future, but everything wears out, everything becomes outdated. They're gonna have it for the best 10 years, for the first and the best 10 years, and I'll repeat again that I think you guys are you know, really making a big mistake there at State Pier. I'm going to point out that I've been attending the meetings in Montville and Ledyard for their large, you know, region-altering, you know, like, you know, maritime industry-altering developments that they have at the Gateway facility in Montville, the Cashman site in Ledyard. You know, I attend the local zoning meetings, the town council meetings, the public hearings. I've never seen anybody from the Port Authority there, never heard any mention of these developments, which are just going to just have a huge impact on the marine future of the state. And I think you guys are preoccupied with the boondoggle down there at State Pier, and I just hope it's on somebody's radar because they have a huge board, you know, significant staff, and you should be sending people to those meetings. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wish to speak at this time? Any other members of the public? Okay, moving on to our next agenda item. We have our annual training with the Office of State Ethics. We are joined by Peter from the office. And I think with that, I don't know, Ulysses, do you want to say anything to introduce this or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to indicate that Veronica Calvert is our ethics liaison and has arranged for this training. So I'm going to turn it over to her for the introduction here. Veronica?
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to introduce Peter Lewandowski. He's the Executive Director of the State Ethics Office. Peter has provided some PowerPoint presentation slides that he's going to go over. Covering various subjects and basically understanding the code of ethics. With that, I'll turn it over to Peter.
Thank you, Veronica. Good afternoon, everyone. Again, for the record, my name is Peter Lewandowski. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of State Ethics. As Veronica noted, you have materials that I forwarded last week to you. A PowerPoint that we use for quasi-public agency board member ethics trainings. And the focus of this presentation is just a basic overview of the main provisions of the Code of Ethics for public officials, use of state position, gifts, conflicts, outside employment, contracting with the state, and finally revolving doors. One thing that I really would like to impart at the outset is the importance of seeking advice whenever you have ethics questions. We are your resource. The Office of State Ethics is here for you to provide any answers you may have. Again, there are no silly questions in ethics. They range from fairly straightforward, kind of refreshing someone's recollection about something they've heard before, to complex questions that will require research and analysis by our staff attorneys. So please do ask questions whenever you have them. One, obviously, the most common way of obtaining advice from our office is by way of informal opinion. You can obviously go through Veronica, your ethics liaison. She can contact our office on your behalf, or you can come directly to us. Just one important note, every quasi-public agency, and for that matter, every state agency, has an internal code of ethics that can be more restrictive than the code of ethics for public officials, or it addresses matters that are specific to the regulatory regimen that the quasi-public or, for example, state agency has, or subject matter that over which you have jurisdiction. There's plenty of information on our website, so feel free to visit our website. The bottom line is when we talk about governmental ethics, there is a common thread that links most of these provisions. And the basic point behind it is that the law is intended to prevent individuals from using their public position or authority for personal financial gain. With that in mind, let's jump into our first provision, the use of state position. In your official capacity, you may not use your state position for your own financial gain, that of your immediate family members. And we're talking about here your spouse, your children, your spouses of your children, parents and siblings, and also any associated businesses. Associated business is a defined term in general statutes. It means any entity through which business for profit or not for profit is conducted, in which you or your spouse is either a director, officer, or holder of, or owner of more than 5% of stock. And one note about associated businesses, that term does not apply to uncompensated or volunteer service on nonprofit boards. I know many of us engage in various community activities. We may serve on community boards of various nonprofit organizations. Provided your engagement with that nonprofit is not compensated in any way, other than just reimbursement of some costs to attend meetings, then in essence, that nonprofit is not considered an associated business, and you can take official action for the benefit of that nonprofit. All right, the other major area of the code is the subject of gifts. Again, I'm providing you with kind of a distilled, kind of abbreviated version of the training. I'm cognizant of the time. The other major area is the subject of gifts. Gift, again, is a defined term in statute. Anything of value directly or personally received, unless consideration of equal value is or greater value is given in return. So there has to be some kind of a market transaction for an item not to be considered a gift. A market transaction, whatever market dictates for an item, if consideration is provided of equal or greater value, then that item is not considered a gift. In your official capacity as members of a quasi-public, you really have to be vigilant about gifts that you may receive from the so-called restricted donors. And the two principal donors from that category of restricted, that restricted category, one, are obviously registered lobbyists. Lobbyists are required to register with the Office of State Ethics, and they range from individuals to major corporations to also nonprofits. If you want to check whether an entity is a registered lobbyist, you can go to our website. We have a real-time registration system, so if someone registered 2 minutes ago, their name will be listed, or their identity, corporate identity, will be listed on our website as a registered lobbyist. So gifts from registered lobbyists are generally prohibited unless applicable gift exception is at play, and I'll talk about exceptions shortly. The other important subgroup of restricted donors that you should keep in mind are entities or persons, individuals, who are either doing or are seeking to do business with the Connecticut Port Authority. So folks who come before you are try to obtain business or engage already in business, those folks are considered restricted as well. And finally, there's a third smaller subgroup, just briefly, DAS, pre-qualified vendor contractor list, those vendors that provide services to state agencies and quasi-public agencies, and that list is provided on the DAS website. But really, the principal focus here for restricted donors is registered lobbyists and entities that are doing business or seeking to do business with the Port Authority. So gifts, as I said, are prohibited, generally speaking, from restricted donors unless applicable gift exception is considered. And common gift exceptions are token items, anything under $10 with the aggregate value of $50 per year per source. And those, by the way, those limits are set in statute, so they are not adjusted for inflation. So they're set, they're established, $10 token items. The other gift exception, common gift exception, is food and beverage. It's perfectly fine, for example, for, let's say, a state contractor or for a lobbyist to provide lunch to a public official to discuss matters, provided that contractor or lobbyist is in attendance and the per-person cost does not exceed $50. I understand, in certain situations, you may go to a restaurant and the per-person cost exceeds $50. In that situation, just simply pay down to 50, the difference that's over 50. Another gift exceptions, rebates and discounts that are available to governmental entities, governmental employees, and are not targeted to specific agencies. So generally speaking, let's say you go to a major corporation, let's say has a one that comes to mind, for example, telecommunications companies may offer governmental discounts. You may partake in those because they're available to all government employees, whether municipal, state, or federal, and so on. Those are fine. Ceremonial plaques, any awards or recognition for your service, a plaque up to $100 is permissible. Gifts to the state, goods or services that are provided to a state agency or quasi-public agency for use on quasi-public agency's property or to support an event, provided these gifts facilitate state action and function of your agency. Those are fine. And finally, one more exception that I'll focus on is attending conferences. If you attend a conference in your official capacity, you may receive costs, travel, lodging, and related conference costs associated with attending a conference under necessary expenses and gifts to the state. I provided you with a two-page description or explanation of the difference between necessary expenses and gifts to the state and how this applies in the context of attending conferences. I will not spend time discussing this. I think this sheet is self-explanatory. It illustrates under what circumstances you may accept these costs from restricted donors to attend the conference in your official capacity. So generally, again, what happens if you accept a prohibited gift? You, let's say, a couple days later, you realize, oh, geez, you know, I accepted something that does not meet the applicable exceptions. Well, don't panic. You have a 30-day window to make it right. You can return the gift or pay fair market value within 30 days. In those rare circumstances where gifts are, it's not practical to return the gift because, let's say, it's a perishable item that's been donated to the office, those can be shared among the staff in the office. But again, it cannot be consumed or used strictly by an individual employee or official. So again, keep in mind you have a 30-day window to return impermissible gifts. Another area that I want to spend some time on is the conflicts of interest provision. This is a very important area of the Code of Ethics and conflicts as a topic. You'll find conflicts in any governmental code of ethics. For that matter, you'll find it in any corporate code of conduct. So conflicts is a very basic provision. And how do you spot conflicts in your official capacity? If you think you will derive financial benefits if you take a certain course of action in your state job or in your quasi-public office, or let's say your spouse or your children or any associated businesses will derive financial benefit by virtue of your official act, and that benefit is distinct from others in a similar situation. And so if the answer to any of these questions, particularly the distinct treatment, is yes, then you have a conflict. And then you have to determine, okay, am I dealing with a direct or potential conflict? And also, is there an appearance of a conflict? Now, I'll discuss these briefly. Let's start with direct conflicts. Direct conflicts are easy to spot. Essentially, you have a reason to believe or expect that either you, your spouse, associated business, your dependent children will obtain direct monetary gain or suffer direct monetary loss by reason of your official activity in a way that is distinctly different from its effect on other persons in the same profession, occupation, large group, industry, for example. So there has to be that distinct treatment for a direct conflict to apply. With direct conflicts, the meaning for direct, it means that it is immediate. It is without intervening conditions. So, for example, you vote on a contract and the entity happens to be an associated business. Let's say your spouse is an officer at a company that is seeking a contract from Port Authority. Your vote on that contract would certainly raise a direct conflict for you because, again, your spouse is an officer. The conflict is direct because by voting by voting on the contract, that contract will accrue to the associated business, and in such situation, you have a direct conflict. Now, when faced with a direct conflict, obviously recusal is required. There's no other way to simply when you're faced with a direct conflict, you simply have to abstain from official action. Now, what about potential conflicts? They're more nuanced. You face potential conflicts when you're required to take official action that would affect the financial interest of either you, your spouse, parents, siblings, children, and also spouses of children, as well as associated businesses. Again, there's no conflict if there's no distinct treatment between you and any other large group segment of the public, for example, all homeowners, all taxpayers, and so on. So, however, if you have a distinct treatment, then you have a potential conflict. Now, what's the test for potential conflicts? You have to have a reasonable expectation that there will be some financial impact based on your actions. There's no requirement that the impact be direct. However, it has to be likely that you will derive financial benefit as opposed to merely being conceivable or possible. So there has to be a likelihood that you will derive financial impact by virtue of your official action. Now, as a quasi-public board member, quasi-public agency board member, your options with respect to potential conflicts is as follows. Because you are a member of a deliberative body, you can either abstain when facing a potential conflict or prepare a written statement on the record. That statement has to be filed, has to be part of the minutes of a public meeting. And in that statement, you have to state, the conflict that you're facing and why, despite the conflict, you can still act in public's interest. And also a copy of that statement has to be filed with the Office of State Ethics. So again, this applies strictly to potential conflicts. So you either abstain or file this written statement. What about appearances of a conflict? Appearances of a conflict are really left to your judgment and discretion. The Code of Ethics in Connecticut is silent on appearances. The Office of State Ethics has no jurisdiction over appearances. So if you are in the clear when it comes to direct and potential conflicts and there's nonetheless an appearance issue, it's ultimately to your discretion whether you still wish to take official action. Sometimes when officials come to us for advice, we'll analyze this fact pattern, we'll state in the opinion that there's no direct or potential conflict. And sometimes if you're a high-ranking official, and especially if you're a member of the board, we'll alert you there may be the potential for appearance concern, but you have no legal obligation to abstain from official action if it's an issue strictly of concerning an appearance of a conflict. All right, I'm almost done. Just a few words very briefly about outside employment. You may not engage in pursue outside employment that will impair your independence of judgment as to your state duties. You may not disclose any confidential information that you've learned by reason of your official activity for the benefit of your outside employment, and you may not use your state position, the authority that you exercise as a board member for the benefit of your outside employment. And also, obviously, that includes the use of materials, use of personnel, use of time, for the benefit of your outside employment. contracting with the state. In terms of contracts with the state, let's say you have an associated business there may be an interest by the associated business to engage Port Authority for a contract. Generally speaking, contracts valued at $100 or more may not be awarded unless they undergo open and public process. Excuse me. This open and public process requirement generally does not apply to quasi-public agencies, and specifically members of quasi-public boards are exempted unless they exercise authority or control over the subject matter of the contract. So if you exercise some authority over the contract before you, that's before Port Authority, that and you wish to, for example, you have an associated business that you that wishes to engage Port Authority for that contract has to undergo open and public process. All right, and finally, just a few words about revolving door provisions. There are four revolving door provisions that you should keep in mind, two lifetime bans and 2 1-year restrictions. Lifetime bans, you may not disclose confidential information upon leaving, once you leave state service, and also you may not represent anyone in matters in which you participated substantially and personally while serving on the board of Port Authority. This is really a side-switching prohibition where you cannot switch sides upon leaving service. You end up working for an entity, and that entity engages Port Authority on a matter, let's say a contract on which you voted or which you had some oversight over that contract. So again, side switching would be prohibited. You would be prohibited from representing that private party. The 1-year restrictions, one is a prohibition on representing others before your former agency, before the quasi-public for 1 year upon leaving the board. Again, the key thing is for compensation. So technically, pro bono representation would be permitted, provided it's truly pro bono. It's not a delayed compensation a year or two or three from now. You can, of course, socialize with your former colleagues immediately upon leaving the quasi-public board, but you may not, again, discuss any business. And finally, the other 1-year restriction is you may not pursue employment with an entity that's been awarded $50,000 or more, a contract valued at $50,000 or more, if you were substantially involved in the award of that contract in the final year of your state service. And just a reminder, as members of the quasi-public agency, as members of Port Authority, you're required by statute to file statements of financial interests. Those are due by May 1st of each year. We'll be happy to assist you in that regard. There's still time to file these, but again, if you have any questions, feel free to contact us regarding the filing of statements of financial interest. I know my time is limited. I'll stop here. Just a reminder, there's a process. It's also provided on our website about our enforcement side of operations, filing of complaints. We have plain language guides on how to file a complaint and the process. Just one thing about our enforcement side of things, keep in mind that our process is confidential in nature up until probable cause is established. And the reason for that, it's important to maintain confidentiality until a judge of the Superior Court determines probable cause. That's a requirement that we take very seriously. It's important. We understand that ethics complaints may have an adverse impact on someone's reputation. Confidentiality is critical until that probable cause is established. Any ethics violations. There are mandatory reporters, heads of quasi-publics, their deputies, heads of procurement, contracting, and human resources are mandatory reporters for purposes of the Code of Ethics if they have a reasonable cause to believe that the person has violated the ethics code. That's all I have. I'll be happy to answer any questions. I know this is really, as I said, an abbreviated version of the ethics training, and it's geared towards members of quasi-public boards. So if you don't have any questions now, again, please contact us later on. We'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Peter, this is Thanks Veronica.
So yes. Hi, Veronica.
Peter, I have a question about the Statement of Financial Interest, the SFIs. You do have the email addresses of all of our existing and new board members. So will they automatically get an email inviting them to do their annual SFIs? Will that come directly from the state ethics office?
Yes. Yes, we have. That's right. We have all the emails. So we'll start on March 15th. We'll start sending notices to all filers of their reminding them of their duty to file the SFI by May 1.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep.
And I just want to remind all of the board members that they will also be receiving an email from me. Which will be the annual board certification, which I will attach to the email a copy of the CPA Code of Ethics policy that they will be asked to review, and they will be asked to acknowledge that they've reviewed it and send their acknowledgement back to me by May 1st also. And Peter, thank you so much for pulling this together. I appreciate the PowerPoint slides. A lot of good information in there.
Thank you. Thank you, Veronica, and thank you for having me.
Hey, before we lose Peter, any other board members have any questions at this time? Great. Thanks, Peter. We appreciate you coming here yourself, and thorough and helpful presentation, as always.
Thank you, David.
With that, we'll move on. Yeah, sorry, Dave, go ahead.
Could I just interrupt you for a second? I apologize. I had lost sound on my end when you went into item number 2 on the agenda, and it came back in the middle of public comment. I assume you voted on the minutes of the December meeting. I'd like that to reflect that I abstained because I wasn't attending that meeting.
Yes, thank you, Dave. Noted. Thank you.
Thanks.
Next item on the agenda is item 5, the Executive Director's Update. Ulysses, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to first join Chairman Kouras in welcoming all new members to the board and invite you to contact me regarding any questions you might have, also for any assistance that I might be able to provide. With respect to my report, I'll start with the financial management, and that is under really the supervision of our finance director, Veronica Calvert. I am happy to report to the board that the financial management operations of the CPA are sound. Bank reconciliations are up to date. 29 individual bank accounts are reconciled monthly. The office continues to work on the state bond allocation Excel file developed by OPM to account for all deposits and withdrawals for prior years and has completed the first and second quarter report for the Office of Fiscal Analysis. Additionally, the State Treasurer's Office bond tax questionnaires were also completed. The office worked with the CPA's insurance broker to verify the financial data used in determining the final fiscal year 2023-2024 insurance premiums, along with allocations between CPA General Operations and the construction project in New London. The office also is working with the town of Fairfielding to complete the return of unused SHIP 1 grant funds. The return will be sent to the State Treasurer's Office and documented in Core Connect, in Core CT, when complete. Regarding state auditors of public accounts, the finance staff has provided all requested financial documentation from the state auditors for the biennial audit for fiscal years 2020 and 2021. With respect to the fiscal audit 2022 audit, our staff worked diligently to obtain a clean, unqualified, unmodified opinion on the fiscal year 2022 audit. No internal control deficiencies or material weaknesses were cited in the audit. I will repeat, for fiscal year 2022 audit, no internal control deficiencies or material weaknesses were cited in the audit. I know you nor the public has seen any reporting on this, but it is a significant accomplishment of this organization and especially our finance operation. Moving on to the annual public hearing. On the evening of December 20th, the board held its annual public hearing for the purpose of evaluating the adequacy of the state's maritime policies. One member of the public provided comment. The recording and notes memorializing the meeting are available on the authority's website. When it comes to the submission of reports, thanks in large part to the Eagle Eye assistance of Andrew Levine, in December, the authority submitted multiple statutorily required reports to the governor's office, various legislative committees, and state auditors of public accounts. They included, number one, the 2022 annual operations and projects report. Number two, the quarterly report regarding the status of pending and current contracts, small harbor projects, and the construction project at the state pier. And number three, the independent audit report for fiscal year ended June 30, 2022. All of these reports are available on the authority's website. Moving on to the procurement update. As you may recall, the passage of Public Act number 21-2 in 2021 resulted in the designation of the authority as a, quote, state contracting agency, end of quote, that shall have its contracting and procurement subjected to oversight by the State Contracting Standards Board. Last year, the authority worked closely with the State Contracting Standards Board and the Office of Policy and Management to develop a new procurement manual to supplement the authority's operating procedures and to guide policies and procedures for future contracts that are greater than $50,000 or terms longer than 1 year. We have several procurements to conduct in 2023, which will meet the threshold of the newly established procurement standards. Most notably, those procurements include legal services, which is a 3-year engagement, and auditing services, another 3-year engagement. These will be the first multi-year procurements conducted since the new procedures were established. We plan to work closely with OPM and the State Contracting Standards Board to utilize their expertise regarding the state contracting requirements and to ensure we have the resources available to conduct successful procurements for those contracts. I have contacted both OPM and the State Contracting Standards Board for their guidance and support. I will keep the board advised of our progress in this regard. When it comes to the issuance of the formal opinion from the State Attorney General's office, as you may recall, the State Contracting Standards Board released a report that alleged the CPA may have acted outside of its authority when it entered into a public-private partnership relative to the New London State Pier project. And subsequently, they decided to seek a formal opinion from the Attorney General. In late January, almost exactly a year after the release of their report, the Attorney General's office released a formal opinion concluding that CPA had and has said authority, which was welcome confirmation of the CPA's response to the State Contracting Board's draft report. Chairman Kouris provided a copy of the opinion to all members of the board, and I will be happy to also provide any new member a copy should you desire. Moving on to the Transportation Committee oversight hearing. On February 1, Chairman Kouris and I appeared before the General Assembly's Transportation Committee for our first oversight hearing of the 2023 legislative session. It was an interactive and informative conversation, including a recap of the authority's prior year activities and challenges, as well as a discussion of future plans for 2023 and beyond. We appreciated the opportunity to answer questions from the committee and learn more about the committee's priorities and expectations of us as a quasi-public agency. We also received a letter from the International Shoremen's Association. Last month, the president of the ILA, Harold Daggett, announced the ILA's endorsement of the State Pier Project. Mr. Daggett also noted in his letter that communications with terminal operator Gateway New London had been, quote, healthy, end of quote, and ongoing. Because of the effectiveness of the communications, there was a meeting in late January to have Gateway and ILA regional committee members brief leaders of the local 1411 as to the progress of the negotiations and to provide the needed orientation of such a new and different operation. We remain confident that an agreement between the parties will be reached in the very near future so training can commence. Next, we are thrilled to announce that the State Pier Infrastructure Improvements Project received its first award, a Project Merit Award for Offshore Wind Infrastructure by the Climate Change Business Journal as part of the Climate Change Business Journal's 2022 Business Achievement Awards. A press release highlighting the selection was forwarded to the media this past weekend. Moving on now to the New Haven Harbor Project, Improvement Project. I executed, as authorized by the board, the design phase agreement on January 3rd with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The New Haven Harbor Strategic Partner meeting was held in February, and the Army Corps confirmed receipt of the CPA's $980,000 sponsor cost share. The items discussed at the meeting were specific to the design components. They included surveys of the entrance channel, the turning basin, West River, and beneficial uses sites, the geophysical analysis and borings scheduled to start late spring, and a final report in the fall. Also, ship simulation efforts are planned for July and August of 2023. The project coordination also continues with Crosstown Cable to assist in the cable realignment. Speaking of Crosstown Cable, the relocation meeting was held on February the 15th with the Corps and the CPA. The Corps shared their performance work statement and Crosstown Cable regarding the scope of work that will be provided by the Corps as the Corps contractor. I will skip right for now the Fort Trumbull and the Ship 3, round 3 updates, although I provided background information in my report because there's really no significant change to report at this point in time. But I'll move on now to the statewide dredging study and the planning assistance to states. The Connecticut Port Authority and the Corps are partnering right now to develop a dredge material placement planning study through the Planning Assistance States Program. The provisions of Section 22 of the Water Resources Development Act provides authority for the Corps to provide water resources planning assistance. The Corps has submitted an agreement and scope to the CPA for approval, and today I'm seeking your approval so the study can commence. With respect to the Kinetic Pilot Commission, the new pilot tariff rate schedule was approved by the CPA board in December. The five-year rate schedule is effective until 2027, and I'd also like to report that additionally all six Connecticut pilots have received their annual license renewals for 2023. I will report on the State Pier New London project under item number 7 in just a few minutes. But that concludes at this point my report to the board in terms of our activities, some of our activities since our last board meeting.
Great. Thanks, Ulysses, for that comprehensive update. Any members of the board have any questions or comments on any of the items covered in Ulysses' report?
David, I have one question.
Yeah, go right ahead, John.
The $980,000 that we paid to the Corps of Army Engineers, is that the only payment that we will incur, the cost incurred? Is that it?
That is the only cost, yes, that will occur for this program. It is
okay.
$980,000. It's a 50-50 split, so I recall,
yeah,
as I understand, and this is our share.
Okay. Cool. As long as there's a cap on that, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Okay, moving on to the next agenda item, committee updates. I'm going to start with sub-bullet 6A here, committee appointments and assignments. For now, we've circulated an updated committee membership. What we've done now is just slot in some the ex officio commissioner or the ex officio member representatives into the committees that their agencies have been on before. So for that, Doug Delena, representing the treasurer's office, will be on finance and audit, compliance and governance. And Chuck Roman, representing DOT, will be slotted in on audit, compliance, and governance. You'll note, though, we do not yet have committee assignments for Felix, representing New London, for Tom, representing Bridgeport, or for John Carter, our newest board member. And so we expect that this will modify slightly over the coming months, and we expect another board appointment or two in the near term as well. And so I guess at this stage, I would just ask all board members to look at it, kind of reconfirm that this is where you want to be. And if you don't have a committee assignment, let me know where your interest lies. And over the course of the coming months, we'll continue to tweak this. But right now we've got, full committee membership so that we can go about our business. But we'll be looking for folks to make sure that they're where they want to be. Any comments or questions on that? Okay, the next part of the committee's update is we had a finance committee meeting this morning at 10 a.m. Nothing particularly substantive to update on. I think I'll just echo some of Ulysses' comments that, I think Veronica has done a fantastic job getting us to where we need to be, where we are finally arrived. We're doing a lot of, tying out of individual accounts on a monthly basis. We've got our full P&L statement. We've got our account balances. Everything is finally sort of in one place so that we can make effective decisions based on that information. I'll just make one comment because we did talk about it a bit at the committee meeting this morning. In response to some of the public comments, we ran a surplus the last couple of years because of our expectation that there would be a lag between construction and revenue generation from the facility. And so we're right where we expect to be. There will be revenue coming in. We talked about the expected timing of that. But we will have lease revenue coming in upon the commencement of those activities this spring. And so despite there being a deficit currently in this fiscal year, we remain, you know, very much on track to where we expected to be, and we are where we expected to be at this time. But I think overall, the story of the finance committee is one of, you know, great job by staff getting us to where we need to be on reporting, so we can wrap our heads around all the broad range of financial information that we need to act upon. I don't know if there's anything that any members of the committee want to add or anything that any other members of the board want to ask at this time. Okay, with that, we'll move on to the next item, and I'll hand it back to Ulysses for an update on the State Pier Infrastructure Improvement Project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At New London State Pier, high levels of activity and construction achievements are taking place in all five of the key construction areas. We are either on schedule or on target of meeting project goals and milestones. For instance, construction of the Northeast Bulkhead heavy lift platform, or what we refer to really as the delivery berth, that will be used to launch the South Fork Wind projects, was completed in October. That is, construction was completed in October, and the deck furniture, such as fenders, bollards, and ladders, are being installed as we meet today and will be completed ahead of substantial completion date, which is 1 week from today, February 28. This summer, at the Northeast Bulkhead Heavy Lift Platform, seagoing barges with tugs, fore and aft, will be shipping 12 turbines for South Fork. In preparation, the Northeast Bulkhead will be receiving offshore wind components this spring by accommodating vessels with lengths up to 185 meters and 34-foot drafts. In the upland area, anyone visiting the site today will see an enormous transformation that is taking place as dense graded aggregate, DGA, which is the final surface, is being proof rolled and compacted and a north to south orientation in preparation for the laydown and staging of offshore wind nacelles, towers, and other components. The local supplier of the DGA has been supplying material consistently to the site, increasing production levels from 2,000 tons per day to over 4,000 tons per day. The CPA's independent testing company has been taking samples for gradation and density testing with results meeting project specifications. The DGA supplier has indicated recently there is a potential to ramp up productivity to 6,000 tons per day in the coming weeks, which is key to meeting our next milestone in April, the turnover date for joint venture Ørsted and Eversource offshore wind operations, which too is on target. Dredging of the turning basin and delivery berth will complete this dredge season. Upwards of 172,000 cubic yards has been dredged to date. We received a permit extension until the end of February to address about 1,500 cubic yards of material located at the annex. The annex is located between the delivery berth and the installation berth. For clarity, however, dredging of the final 14,000 cubic yards, which represents about 9% of the total dredge material, which is adjacent to the State Pier installation berth and has been now rescheduled for November. The dredge depths are minus 36 at the Northeast Bulkhead turning basin and a minus 38 at the installation berth. Moving to the central wharf and south wall, final impact driving of the pipe and sheet pile along the south wall continues from an east to west direction. As noted in my previous board report, dense soil labor levels below elevation minus 40
and possible obstructions and insufficient tension capacity within the subsurface soils have impacted the contractor's productivity. The contractor has mobilized additional augers and drills to address the impact. Furthermore, redesign of the south wall's anchor wall is continuing to address the unique surface subsoil characteristics that are understood to have resulted in insufficient tension capacity, as well as the contractor's ability to maintain pile tolerances. Our construction administrator will describe this in greater detail in just a moment. With respect to the State Pier toe wall, driving of the 145 foundation piles was nearly completed in January, except for 12 piles of the 145 that have not yet reached design tip elevation. The contractor has scheduled the final driving of these piles for summer after the last concrete deck is poured for the State Pier heavy lift platform. Supply chain issues are primarily affecting us in the electrical component area and will have an impact on final completion of the project, that is final construction project completion this fall. Some electrical devices are scheduled for delivery and installation during the months of September and October. However, it should be noted that these equipment deliveries will not impact the electrical equipment commissioning timeframe, nor commencement of the operator's South Fork Wind project, both of which are planned for this spring. Currently, we are aggressively transitioning from construction to terminal operations. Trailers will be leaving next month. A new entrance is being installed this month, and temporary New London office and construction laydown space is being negotiated. High mast lighting is underway. 7 of 10 high mast lighting foundations have been installed and are ready to accept installation of the light poles. The remaining 3 are in production right now and should be completed within the next couple of weeks. I have asked Joe Salvatore to lead and coordinate an operations work group. His team consists of the CPA, Operator Gateway Terminal, Northeast Offshore members, construction administrator, the engineer of record, the construction manager, Kiewit, as well as the U.S. Coast Guard and the Connecticut and some Connecticut pilots. They are all tackling such issues as security fencing at gates, that is both permanent and temporary fencing, demobilization of office trailers, reviewing site plans and schedules for the remaining construction activities, reviewing the terminal operator's site laydown plan specific to South Fork, status updates on required FAA and stormwater permits, Eversource energization of the site, and critical electric component installations, as well as pilot training. As I stated in my previous report to the board, we are engaged in a series of complex negotiations regarding the development of a fair final path forward to project construction completion this fall. Negotiations regarding an amended Harbor Development Agreement, or HDA, and final GMP are progressing and is expected to necessitate a special meeting of the board. Every hand is on deck, and the entire project team is committed to making the State Pier in New London the first operational United States-based heavy lift marine terminal that will accommodate offshore wind nacelles, towers, blades, and other maritime cargoes. Our terminal will also be the first offshore wind terminal that the first United States-built wind turbine installation vessel, the Charybdis, will deploy in 2024 for the Revolution Wind project. By the way, we are transforming a terminal while the first U.S. installation vessel is being built by Dominion in Texas and having to adjust some specifications simultaneously.
Connecticut is at the forefront of a new and exciting jobs-producing sustainable energy industry. I will now call on our construction administrator, Marlon Peterson, for a more detailed construction update. Marlon?
Thank you, Ulysses. Good afternoon, Board. As the Executive Director noted, during the month of February, significant construction activities are occurring at the major work fronts with a particular focus, as noted, on the Northeast Bulkhead heavy lift platform and the adjacent upland. Following the contractor's substantial completion next week, as outlined previously, our construction manager, the engineer, ourselves, the construction administrator, will commence the closeout activities for this portion of the site with subsequent turnover to the authority for follow-on operations by its tenant. As noted by the executive director, activities across the upland continue. This effort includes the redesign of the annex area to address the existing soil's limited tension capacity, the placement of additional 30-inch diameter pipe piles, the adjacent anchor wall, its combi wall, and the tie rods that provide the structural rigidity within the annex are all underway, with the work scheduled to complete next Saturday, February 25th. Completion of the annex tie-back wall, as noted previously by the director, is a precursor to then following to completing the dredging of the 1,500 remaining cubic yards, and that's scheduled for the end of the month. So the number one highlight for ourselves is we want to be completing that northeast platform and adjacent berth literally within the next 7 days. A revision from the previous meeting, Ulysses was talking about dredging. There's an inshore portion of the installation berth that has been rescheduled to the next dredge season, which commences in October and November of 23. This final 14,000 cubic yards is immediately adjacent to the state pier, and per our engineer's guidance, removal of this material is unable to be done because several of our king pile, 12 to be exact, and the associated sheet pile located along that tow wall have not, you'll see them driven today, but they are not driven to their design depth. The engineer's concern is that potential rotation of the pile in the deck structure could negatively impact its heavy lift capacity. Hence, the idea or our approach is that those remaining piles will be driven later this summer and fall once the balance of the concrete decks are put in place. At the south wall, insufficient tension capacity has also been identified through testing. Similar to our northeast bulkhead annex area, redesign of the south wall's anchor wall is continuing to address the unique subsurface soil characteristics, as well as the contractor's ability to maintain pile driving tolerances. The engineer has identified that additional 30-inch pipe pile will replace the driven H piles, and together with the anchor wall and the tie rods will provide the required strength to retain, or if you would, hold in place, the new south wall combi wall and central wharf fill. In the upcoming spring, the construction sequence will be the completion of the pile driving, anchor wall placement, installation of tie rods, placement of final fill material within the last remaining wedge that you see on the site, and then lastly, completion of the DGA. These activities are all scheduled to complete this summer of 23. Lastly, driving of the 185 state pier platform piles is nearly complete. We have four left to be done to reach final tip elevation, and the contractor is working with augers, drills, and buckets to remove either A, dense material, or B, boulders that are located some 20 to 30 feet below the mud line. Once that work is complete, the heavy lift platform will continue the welding of shear rings within the pipe piles, setting of the rebar cages, pouring of the concrete plugs, placement of the riprap underneath the slope of the heavy lift platform, erecting the formwork, installing rebar, pouring concrete beams and slabs. Those activities will take us from where we are today to finishing up in late summer. Approximately 15% of the concrete beams have been placed to date, with the first of five concrete slabs to be placed in late April. As of February, as of this to date, the value of work completed on site is approximately $180 million, and consistent with the activities detailed by the executive director and in this update, State Pier construction is scheduled to complete this fall. One item to potentially address the question of DGA, and for the board's information, there is predetermined independent testing of any material that arrives on site. That independent testing results identified that the material as originally delivered was non-compliant with the project's gradation criteria. Hence, the material was removed from the site by the contractor at no additional cost to the authority, and the contractor elected to move to an alternative supplier. The works are proceeding in compliance with the specifications as noted by the executive director. With that, this ends the construction update for the month of February. Thank you.
Thanks, Ulysses, and thanks, Marlon. I just want to remind members of the board, but certainly members of the public, that, you know, statepiernewlondon.com has additional information and photographs. I particularly recommend the dashboards. I find them to be very helpful in showing updated pictures in the various work areas. The most recent dashboard was just posted this past Friday. They're posted at least monthly. And so I would encourage everyone to go on there, take a look. It gives very visual and graphic representation of all the different work areas that were discussed. And maybe for the public as well, since I think there's oftentimes some confusion, because when we talk about State Pier, I think a lot of people use that term to refer to the entire facility. When we talk about it in terms of construction updates, it's a very specific area of the facility. And so I think I'll give just a very, very brief executive summary to make sure that the public is clear in terms of the different components of the facility and when they'll be delivered. As Ulysses said, the northeast bulkhead and the delivery berth were finished just a couple months ago. Or the berth was finished a couple months ago. The dredging and the DGA and the accoutrements, the bollards and the and other aspects, the ladders, fenders. Thank you. Are all being finished now. And so that component, that berth, will be finished at the end of this month, as Marlon said. The bulk of the facility, all of the upland area, the railroad parcel, the warehouse, where all the storage will be finished in April. And so when we talk about NEO taking over the facility, when we talk about Gateway mobilizing to operate the facility, when we talk about the first wind farm coming in, that's on the northeast bulkhead and all of the contiguous upland facilities. The areas where we're having trouble that we keep describing month after month are the south wall and the State Pier relieving platform and the tow wall below it. If you look at the facility, it's essentially a backwards uppercase L, the eastern and southern edge. Those are the limited areas that will be delivered later this year. And so the first component finished this month. The bulk of the facility finished about a month after that. And then these remaining pieces on the State Pier relieving platform on the eastern edge and the south wall on the southern edge come some months after. And that's where we're still working on redesign to address these unforeseen subsurface conditions that are resulting in performance different than what we anticipated. So hopefully that helps people understand when we talk about these different dates, the different parts of the facility, how that sequence plays out. With that, questions, comments from any members of the board on anything you heard from Ulysses or Marlon?
Yeah, David, this is I have a question.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. I'm hearing that pretty much things are going well. However, there's a lot more to do. There's going to be a lot more to do later in the year. These piles, still 12 piles have to be driven, and then you have some issues on the south south wall or south face. What are you anticipating, Ulysses, cost overruns as of now, taking into account these things that seem to be delayed? What are we talking about? What kind of money are you going to be looking for?
That's what is in discussions and negotiations right now. And when I indicated we're looking at a final path forward from all of our project partners, that's what's under discussion right now. We are now, when it comes to also the risk and cost, that's all trying, we're trying to assess all of that. And that's when I indicated that we may have to have, and it's going to necessitate, no doubt, a special meeting. Those negotiations are progressing. They're progressing well on all fronts. And I think we are very close.
Hey, Gladwin, stop them.
Say that again? I'm sorry? Okay. And I'm confident that we will have something in the very near future to basically share with the board with respect to both issues about schedule and cost.
Okay, I appreciate that, but you're saying the negotiations are going rather well. At this point, what are we talking, $1 million, $10 million, $50 million? Give us an idea. You must have an idea.
Yeah, right, but, well, it's premature right now when you're in negotiations with all the parties to start talking about numbers at this point in time, because and I think you will appreciate that when you're in negotiations, it's not a good idea to start talking about numbers when those numbers have not been finalized with all the parties. So that's all what's right. taking place right now.
Okay, so you can't give us any idea of how much money this is going to end up being.
Not at right. this- Not right now, but we're close.
Thank
we're
you.
Close.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay.
Was there another question?
Yes, this is Doug DeLena representing the treasurer. I just, first of all, I want to say thanks for that report for a new member that helps me understand, especially, David, your kind of extemporaneous executive summary of that was really helpful because it answered questions that I was going to ask about, you know, the difference between what is expected to be completed soon and how that affects the South Fork project and, you know, a turnover of a lot of the facility as opposed to these other items that will be completed over the summer or the fall. So I just was hoping that you could just elaborate a little bit more on and kind of tie the knot for us on how those distinctions between the timeline and the remaining item tie into what you were talking about before about the budget and projected revenue that's supposed to start very soon. How that affects your level of confidence in that projected revenue.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Doug. It is our expectation that when the facility begins to be handed over in March to Gateway and then begins to be utilized by NEO in April, that will commence their lease of the facility in its entirety. And so despite there being aspects of the facility that will remain to be completed later this year and will be mobilized in time for the next project for Revolution Wind, we expect that the revenue, the lease revenue will come in for the full facility this spring. But again, that revenue comes in on a quarterly basis. And so we would expect that the first quarter payment would be made in March for the quarter beginning April 1st. But it will not be prorated, to reflect the fact that a small portion of the facility is not yet complete.
Great. Thank you very much. That answers my question.
Great. Other questions?
David, I have one question to Marlon.
Yep. Go right ahead.
In your last paragraph in your report, you say that we have $180 million in the value of the work so far. Does that include the dredging?
That includes the vast majority of dredging. They of course, were active through the month of February, so the current month number is not, but yes, it does include dredging activity to date.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you.
And just to reiterate on that dredging question, John, I think it was 91% of the dredge will be completed by the end of this month, with that last remaining little bit, leaving 9% at the state pier berth for later this year.
Right. Okay.
Other questions?
David, it's Parker. I have a question I'm not quite sure who it's for, but I'm wondering if there's going to be additional dredging, is there still sufficient room at the site we're using for disposing of the dredge materials? I've forgotten where they dumped offshore, I think.
It is disposed of in the upland, and it is a regulated facility in New Jersey, as a matter of fact. So, yes, there is remaining capacity at that facility.
Great. Thank you.
Any other questions? Great. Moving on to the next agenda item, consideration and approval of a resolution authorizing the executive director to negotiate and enter into a planning assistance to state's agreement with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a dredge material placement planning study. Let's see. You know, I apologize. I don't actually have a resolution language at my fingertips, but Ulysses and Joe, I'll bounce it over to you first to describe this item, and then I will read a resolution.
Okay. No, I described where we were in my report, and I'll ask Joe to perhaps give any highlights that he thinks that perhaps we need to actually add to the report. Joe?
Thank you. Yes, I can add a few things while David's looking for the resolution. The Port Authority requested planning assistance in preparing a comprehensive plan for dredge material disposal facility siting in Long Island Sound in support of long-term, safe, and efficient commercial and recreational navigation for the state's ports and harbors. The comprehensive plan would build upon the recommendations made in the December 2015 Regional Dredge Material Management Plan, otherwise known as the DMMP for Long Island Sound. Some of the study tasks that we're going to be embarking on, we're scoping and project management plan, assessment of dredging needs, update current and potential placement sites, screen sites to smaller set of priority sites, scope and conduct investigations at priority sites, conduct stakeholder public informational activities, meetings. Project management, the Corps will be responsible for leading the study team in performing the study and managing the study scope, schedule, and budget. Study reviews, district quality control, sponsor review, agency review, regional dredge team review, and prepare a draft and final report. This study, final report should be December of 24. We'll be starting this month once the agreement is executed. The proposed study portion of this, the initial study portion, is valued at $1.5 million, of which 50% is the state/Port Authority's responsibility. So upon approval and execution of this agreement, $750,000 will get transferred to the Army Corps to kick off the study. And that would conclude additional information.
Great. Thanks, Joe. I will have to make the resolution up on the spot, which I think we've done this enough. We know generally what it needs to say. I'll read it. I'll entertain a motion and second, and then we can have any further discussion, and folks can ask Joe or Ulysses any questions that they might have. Resolved that the Board of Directors hereby authorizes the Executive Director to enter into and negotiate an agreement with the Army Corps of Engineers surrounding a planning assistance to states agreement for the purposes of completing a dredge material placement planning study and any other agreements necessary in the furtherance thereof. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
So moved, David. Tom Gill.
Moved by Tom. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by John. Any discussion, questions, or comments for Joe or Ulysses? Okay. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, approved unanimously. In old business, we have transitioned to a hybrid meeting format, which I know we've been talking about for a few months. I think with ample time before our April meeting, we'll be able to actually pull it off this time. We have been thinking about New Haven as a good first in-person meeting spot, but welcome anyone's feedback and suggestions on that topic. What we'd ultimately like to do is start rotating the meetings around and first with our deep water cities, give them an opportunity and their local port authorities to share some information about what's going on there, engage into a discussion regarding that with our board, but looking for feedback from folks on that as we go forward. Any questions or comments on that? Any
David,
other old? Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Dave Perillo, I had just a couple quick questions on the financial report, but it really wasn't for the Finance Committee. I'd like to ask Ulysses just a couple quick questions because he would be able to, probably best person be able to tell me what the expenses really were. And Ulysses, these relate to legal services. The internal matters, you know, you've got, you know, a few dollars related to employment. But basically, what is internal general corporate legal expenses? Give me an idea of what they are.
Is he asking? The internal legal, the internal legal and external legal have been separated in our finances in order to more clearly delineate those expenses that are actually being generated as a result of the FOI as actually being pilot commission as well.
No,
those expenses
that is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Ulysses. I'm talking about legal services, internal matters. I see the FOI and all the other things, but the 9,000 that are just called general corporate, what do they involve? I'm not saying it's 9,000, but give me an idea.
I see. That would be, let's say, contract review types of matters that we would ask and we would request of Robinson and Cole. Those are generally contract review matters.
Nothing to do with the Save Pier project, I assume.
No.
Okay, so what type of contract? We don't have that many that involve the administrative side of the CPA. So what would they be for? All right, well, let's put that aside. I do want to go down.
Actually,
No, I would like actually, to go down legal services external matters regarding the Pilot Commission administrative hearing.
Yeah.
It appears the Port Authority has spent over $30,000 on that hearing. And I'm wondering why, because all the procedures for administrative hearings for the pilots especially had been developed over years by the DOT, and that information was available to the CPA as far as how to handle this administrative hearing. I'd like to know, does that include the hearing officer in the, that little over $30,000 figure? And since that information was available, and since we have two sitting pilot commissioners that are attorneys, and I know one for a fact, if not both, have been involved in administrative hearings for years and years, I mean, why are we paying $32,000 to attorneys for that?
Well, there was no procedure available to the CPA. We had to create, and I had to create this from basically from scratch along with our assistance from our counsel as well. So
all right.
I contacted the Department of Transportation as well and asked for any assistance that they could provide, and they could not provide any at that particular time. Because there was only one hearing, they said, that was ever held, and they said that was held roughly about 2005. There was no information. So we recreated everything for the CPA. That now is a system and a process that's in place going forward for future incidents of this matter, of this nature. This is the first time that an administrative hearing has been requested in over 15 years. So there was nothing. We recreated it, and we recreated it with the assistance of counsel. So it is now established, and it is established by way of state law, rules, and regulations.
Did you ask Attorney Bohannon and Attorney Isley about this, or did you just automatically go to Robinson Cole?
I spoke with several commissioners and former commissioners prior to, yes, I did. And so there were several people consulted with respect to this process, but there was nothing in place. So we had to make sure that we were creating it from a legal standpoint, make sure that we were creating it that in a way that in the future would withstand the test of time.
Yeah. And I understand at the end of the hearing, the resolution resulted in a fine to a pilot. And that fine, what was that fine? $500, $750?
I'm trying to remember. The fine... I will get that for you. I can't remember exactly because I want to be very exact about this. I will get that for you.
And I believe that the stipulated agreement was circulated to the board when we had to act on the outcome of that hearing at our December meeting.
Well, I don't dispute it. I just wondered what that fine amount was. I don't have that information with me.
I will get you that information.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in the future, Dave, I think those are totally reasonable questions to bring up during the Finance Committee update. It's meant to cover all the finances. It's not just for the committee chair. It's an opportunity to interact with staff on those topics as well. Any other old business? Any new business?
The OFA quarterly report.
Thank you, Ulysses. So the Finance Committee at the meeting this morning took up the quarterly report to the Office of Fiscal Administration. with a recommendation that it be approved by the full board under new business. I will first entertain a motion that will require two-thirds majority to take this item up as new business. And so is there a motion for the board to take up the quarterly Office of the quarterly report to the Office of Fiscal Administration for the quarter ending December 31st, 2022.
I'll move that, David.
Move by Grant. Is there a second to take up the item?
Tom Patton, second.
Second by Tom. All those in favor of or any discussion? All those in favor of taking up the item, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstention? Okay, taking up the item as new business, the Finance Committee this morning discussed a new format that Veronica has been working on in response to questions from the board and from that committee. The end result, we think, is a more complete accounting. Just to summarize the difference for folks that were not participating in or listening into that committee, one of our accounts was not previously on that report, and it is our core account, which our DOT appropriation of $400,000 flows through and into payroll. And so we determined that adding that was a more accurate, complete story of our cumulative account positions. And so this quarterly report now includes that account. The Finance Committee was happy with how it was presented and recommends approval by the board. Is there a motion to approve the quarterly report ending December 31st, 2022 for submission to the Office of Fiscal Analysis?
So moved, David.
Moved by John. Is there a second?
Second
by Grant. Thank you. Any discussion, questions, or comments? Okay. All those in favor, please indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Thank you. Motion is approved. And with that, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Johnson.
Moved by John. Is there a second?
Second, Parker.
Second, Tom Gill.
Second by Parker and others. Meeting is adjourned at 1:40 p.m. Thank you, everyone, for participating. And sorry we went a few minutes over. Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Parker.
Take care.
Thank you.